USDA this week released a much-anticipated investigation into the cattle and boxed beef markets. The Senate is making progress on the next round of COVID relief, we think. China is on a buying binge while telling the U.S. to watch our step. We've got a lot to cover, and we've got it queued up and ready to go on this week's Free for All.
Live from the news year that just keeps on giving via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk.
It's a big program.
This morning we'll begin with Mark Dopp, Senior Vice President from the North American Meat Institute, and then we'll wrap up the week with our Friday Free for All. Panelists Jim Wiesmeyer, Pam Johnson, and Sean Haney all on hand. And right after the news, Jennifer Scheich from Farm Journal's Pork. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson, and now your beloved host, Chip Flory.
All right, Davis, thank you so much. Hey, it feels like we're a bit more closer, maybe back to kind of normal again this morning. Mm-hmm. Does it feel any different to you?
It definitely feels more closer. Yes.
Okay.
A lot more closer.
We've got Big Apple Joe Stackler back in the studio. Thank goodness for that. All the health scare for the time being has faded at our South Bend headquarters for Farm Journal Broadcasting. And yes, we've got Big Apple Joe back in the studio. So we're glad that that is happening.
Well, you know what that, they say, an apple a day and whatnot. I mean, there's gotta be a play on that somewhere. Right.
Exactly. Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And just because we've got Big Apple back in the studio does not rule out any glitches. Okay. Glitches can still happen in live radio, just so everybody knows.
Oh, you can't say that. Come on now. The gremlins just perked up and picked up their tiny little hammers. And ding, 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 ding. They're banging on stuff right now.
That's right. Monkey wrenches, here they come. Baseball started.
Yes.
Baseball started. I kind of flipped channels, checked out some games last night. Seemed weird, you know, looking at how some of the graphics are being used, trying to make it appear that there might be people in the stands, the crowd noise. I think I would really miss it if it was – I would really miss the crowd noise if it wasn't there. I mean, just that deathly quiet stadium with baseball happening.
Wait, they piped in canned crowd noise for these
games? Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Including crowd reaction. So it's not just that low hum. Yeah, there you go. There you go. It's not just that low hum in the background. If somebody does something, you know, worthy of a cheer, there's a cheer.
Yes.
Yeah.
I can do that too.
You can.
Maybe we should start a baseball team.
We should maybe do that. We should look into it. How much fun would that be?
I don't know. I don't care for baseball.
We got a lot to cover. Let's get to it. What you got in the news, man?
Chip, after the U.S. State Department ordered the closure of a Chinese consulate in Houston earlier this week, China said, oh, yeah? Retaliating by ordering the closure of a U.S. consulate in the southwestern city of Chengdu. The Chengdu consulate was established in 1985 by then-sitting Vice President George H.W. Bush and serves U.S. citizens, handles visa services, and promotes cooperation in agriculture, trade, and education, and other like matters. While an official timeline was not issued by the Chinese government, state-owned Global Times reported the U.S. was given 72 hours. That mirrors the timeline given to China for closing its Houston office. Chinese officials continue to label actions by the U.S. State Department as erroneous and lays the responsibility for rising tensions at the feet of the United States. In a speech yesterday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said China is working to usurp global order, Chip.
International tit for tat. That's what we've got going on here now. And this is the kind of stuff that reminds us of Cold War stuff. And obviously the relationship with China and China's buying binge of U.S. commodities is going to be a topic on the Free for All today.
Well, congressional watchers say the next COVID relief aid package may be mired in discussions until the second week of August. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has been forced to postpone the announcement of the Senate's package as Senate leaders and Trump administration officials do not agree on how to extend unemployment benefits and other non-pandemic related provisions. McConnell said, quote, the administration has requested additional time to review the fine details, but we will be laying down this proposal early next week, Chip.
Yeah, domestic tit for tat is about to get started here is what it looks like to me, because
it's a
theme. I mean if the Senate can delay this deeper and deeper and deeper, what does that do to the time off for the House? I mean, it just makes it that much shorter. It's going to make things that much more complicated for the arm of the government that where everybody is up for re-election this fall. It just seems like a situation getting out of control.
Well, in that coming aid package, the Senate is calling for $20 billion in fresh ag aid funding. The measure would direct the ag secretary to use $14 billion in USDA CCC funds. Excuse me. The House plan would call for $68 billion in ag funding, with $16.5 billion in direct aid to farmers, but no assistance earmarked for 2020 crops, Chip.
We're going to get an update from Wiesmeyer on that in the free-for-all. There might be some wiggle room somehow, some way to get something in there on the 2020.
President Trump yesterday pointed to school lunches as a main reason schools need to reopen for in-person classes in the coming fall. The president noted figures which say as many as 30 million children rely on meals at school amid a certain level of food insecurity. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have released refreshed guidelines for schools in light of the pandemic. And quickly here, Chip, let me add this one. The economic difficulties caused by the coronavirus outbreak has marked a new milestone, with permanent business closures now outnumbering temporary closures. That's according to a Washington Post article. Chip.
We are going to talk about that. Think about that, Davis. Permanent business closures outnumbering the temporary closures. This is the kind of stuff that scares you.
And this
is serious. This is an economic collapse, obviously. All right. Thanks, buddy. Let's bring in Jennifer Shike, editor of Farm Journal's Pork. How you doing, Jennifer?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good, good. Packing plants are doing everything they can to make a safe environment, and there's some new technology getting put to use, right?
Yeah, there's been some reports that are coming out of Tyson and JBS USA installing ultraviolet air cleaning equipment in some of their plants. I don't think it's in all the plants at this time, but it's something they're starting to test to see if they can figure out how a better airflow may help benefit their team members during the pandemic, as reports start coming out that the virus may be more airborne than they thought.
You know, and then that Columbus Junction, I know that you've been following it very closely there, Jennifer, but the case count there at Columbus Junction was actually much higher than originally anticipated or originally reported, right?
Right. I think that when the initial reports went out, it was all the tests they had had at a certain time, and then more tests were done, and those weren't as big in the news. So it's definitely something that, you know, in the close environment and those lower air temperatures make it a little bit easier for viruses to possibly survive in the air longer. And so this might be one way to slow that down.
Which makes the UV technology that much more important. Jennifer, tell me you're going to make time for the grill.
Well, I'm working. I have to have a few more practice sessions. It's been a rough week, but you know, hey, we learn.
Get after it. All right. Thank you, Jennifer. That is Jennifer Shike, editor of Farm Journal's Pork. We've got the free-for-all and Mark Dopp from the North American Meat Institute up next. No doubt you've heard of MetLife, but did you know that MetLife Investment Management has over 100 years of ag lending experience? The MetLife Investment Management team maintains close relationships with its borrowers and can structure a customized loan with flexible terms to meet your financial needs. Looking to expand, refinance, or recapitalize? Consider MetLife Investment Management. Learn more at MetLife.com/ag.
America's conservation ag movement would like to recognize Corteva for its efforts in contributing to healthier, more resilient production agriculture systems. To learn more, visit agweb.com/ACAM.
All right, welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your host, Chip Flory. It is a Friday free-for-all. And you know what? Before we welcome in our special guest, let's go ahead and bring in the regulars. Jim Wiesmeyer, Pro Farmer Policy Analyst. How are you this morning, Jim?
Well, the Nats are 0-1, but there's hope.
Well, it feels like you've already given up.
You know me, Chip. I'm a poor loser.
Yes, you are. Sean Haney. Sean Haney, Real Agriculture, Real Ag Radio. Welcome.
This is like deja vu. I remember this last year, Jim was calling it quits. Didn't like that, this is just amazing. Fire the manager.
Haney, your team doesn't even have a place to stay, to play.
No, it's a 60-day road trip. Yeah, it's just
60-day road trip for the Toronto Blue Jays.
They're exactly. Hoping to play out of Baltimore. So, right. Yeah, crazy. It's what an unusual season.
Season started, and we're hoping to find a home.
Yeah, yeah.
Pam Johnson, Iowa farmer, past president of NCGA and Mazal. Pam, welcome back to the free-for-all. How are you?
I'm great. Good morning.
Good morning to you. How are things looking up your way?
Well, knock on wood, pretty good. Although I just saw yesterday 15 really good crop-growing counties in Iowa are really under severe drought. So,
yeah, over in the west central part of the state and into the central part of the state, it's all of Crop District 4. There is some awfully impressive crop ground in that crop district, but it gets into Crop District 1 in the northwest, Crop District 7 down in the southwest too. Some big yielding areas over there that are dealing with at least abnormally dry and all the way to severe drought. So it's kind of a dicey situation. Okay, let's bring in a special guest. You guys ready for this? We've got Mark Dopp. Mark is the Senior VP for Regulatory Affairs and Scientific Affairs for the North American Meat Institute. He joins us right now. Mark, it's good to talk with you. Thanks for making time.
Good morning. Happy to do it. And can I say something to Jim before we start?
Sure.
Jim, don't give up. Don't give up hope, Jim. I've got my World Series champion fight finish T-shirt on today.
I do. Well, I've got one. I just didn't wear it.
Good for you. Good for you. You know, you've got the Nationals, and you've also got that Washington football team.
They're even complaining about that name now, Jim. there's no hope.
Love it. Okay, Mark, the investigation USDA released a report this week. The reaction that I've picked up from across the spectrum has been, see, told you, markets work, to what else did you expect in this report? Where does the North American Meat Institute fall on the reaction to the report?
Probably along the lines of C told you more so than anything else. I'll say this. I think the report did a good job of laying out the facts. I think the agency did a pretty good job and the chief economist did a pretty good job of analyzing those facts and saying this is not terribly surprising. And frankly, what you see in there in terms of that analysis is pretty much what we have been saying all along. The Holcomb fire was obviously an unfortunate circumstance, and the pandemic has just been a disaster for everyone, especially for the producers. But when you remove 40%, 35 to 40% of the processing capacity, it's not terribly surprising that we saw what we saw.
Yeah. And what we saw was because we removed that capacity on the processing side was reduced demand for cattle. Therefore, lower cattle prices or pressure on cattle prices. But because you're reducing your production and you're maintaining your retail demand for beef, there is a quote-unquote beef shortage drove the box beef price up, and we had that record spread between cash cattle prices and the box beef market. But, Mark, you got to admit that's awfully hard for some of the guys in the feed yard business, well, the cow-calf business. All the cattle industry, it's hard for them to take when they're looking at their negative returns.
You're absolutely right. I wholly appreciate that. And listen, we are sympathetic about this. I apologize for my dual alarm system here.
Love it.
No, I understand completely the the concerns and the probably a great deal of frustration that but again, the dynamics of the market are what they are. I mean, there were a lot of challenges back in April. I've been doing this for 36 years, right? And I think April and May were probably the two most challenging months of my career in terms of attempting to keep plants open or operating as close to full capacity as they could, given the absenteeism and the positives and the struggles and the challenges presented by certain, I'm not criticizing, but certain localities. It has been a very difficult time for everybody, and probably more so for producers than anybody else.
Right, right. Sean, I know that you had a question for Mark.
Yeah, Mark, was there anything in the report in terms of the go forward? Obviously, there's a huge look back here in terms of what happened and trying to explain it all. But was there things to take out of the report in terms of, okay, what do we do about the future? Anything to take out of that?
Well, a couple thoughts. Obviously, the report had a handful of recommendations toward the end. And some of them, I think, are no-brainers. If USDA or whomever can do something to help producers reduce risk, some of those suggestions, it seems to me that everybody ought to be in favor of that. There are a couple other things that I think everybody ought to stop and think about in terms of whether that makes sense. I mean, it seems to me that making dramatic changes in the midst of a pandemic may not be the most prudent course of action. For example, one of the items that got listed was talking about finding a way to move product in interstate commerce. And there were some bills up on the Hill that have been kicked around, the Prime Act and Direct and that. My only caution there is I think we need to make very, very, very sure that there's nothing that in any way, shape, or form, calls into question the safety of the food supply.
Right.
Because that's something we just can't have. The other issue that immediately I think people are going to glom onto is this reference to price discovery, and that needs to be considered very carefully, because it wasn't very well fleshed out, frankly. So there's obviously going to have to be a lot more conversation, but I worry a little bit about, sort of a knee-jerk effort to involve the government in Jim will remember this price reporting. I was one of the people in the room when they wrote the law, and that was back in 1999. The price reporting program is intended to reflect the market. What I saw in there may be something where the price reporting program might be starting to direct the market. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something we ought to think about very seriously. That's a market change, and one that might have a lot of unintended consequences that are adverse.
Yeah, yesterday we had Senator Chuck Grassley on the show with us, Mark, and when I got done with the conversation with him, I went back and listened to it, and the question came up after the conversation in my mind, whether or not we can even regulate transparency. I don't know if it's possible. Is it possible to come up with some set of regulation that would force transparency into the marketplace?
Well, the short answer is I don't know. I've got not the longstanding practicing economist that Jim is. I mean, I've got a couple of degrees in that area, 2.5 or something like that. But it's been a long time since I was really practicing in that area, doing that kind of work. That's a very difficult needle to thread, isn't it?
Yes.
The system, the market has evolved the way it did for a variety of reasons. I worry a little bit about, I respect the senator, and I've read his 5014 bill, but I think that is a real problem, because there again, you've got the government essentially directing how people procure livestock, and there are going to be winners. That's the government picking winners and losers in the market. I don't think that's appropriate. We've shifted to the use of marketing agreements, and that shift has been largely, as I understand it, a function of what the producers have asked for.
Right.
And for every mandated cash transaction, you may be telling somebody else who has a marketing agreement, sorry, yeah, I can't fulfill the agreement today. I've got to do something else because the government's telling me I have to.
Right. Mark, 30 seconds on this one. The meatpacking employees of Pennsylvania sued OSHA, alleging failure to protect frontline workers. What's your reaction to that?
I think it's a grandstanding play. I happen to know the company. They're a member of ours, and I happen to know that some of what you read in the press is simply flat out wrong. Let me say this, like I said earlier, April and May was a really difficult time for the packing industry. There were a lot of things that the industry needed to learn. If you can find me the person who saw this pandemic coming back in January, I will be very surprised. But we've learned a lot. And if you look at the performance, the controls that have been put in place, not just at the Pennsylvania facility, but across the country in packing plants, our numbers are really good. I mean, our positives, our infections are really down at a time when the country is experiencing greater positives and illnesses.
Thank you, Mark.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
And joining us now is Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady. Brian, this wheat market, I tell you, started the week out under some pressure, and then it tried to recover during the course of the week, and here we are racing into the end of the week. What's going on?
Yeah, explosive buying here to finish out the week, or at least explosive gains. I think a lot of it has to do with the U.S. dollar being under pressure, continue to fall there. Some hope that the U.S. will see increased export demand. Now, the last two reporting weeks for the weekly export sales were pretty good, but we do need to see more on a stronger basis consistently for U.S. wheat. And we've seen with some of the international tenders, U.S. prices are still just over the rest of the world at this point. So we need that dollar to continue to fall to get some of that export business.
Gotcha. A little bit of spillover support into the corn market, huh?
Yeah, a little bit. It's trying at least. And you know, that's kind of been the pattern, or at least was last week, where we finished the week on a pretty solid note. So we'll see into the weekend. Not much buyer interest in the soybean market this morning. And that's despite another daily export sale. Now, the one today was to unknown destination. And it was an accumulation. So basically, there were four cargoes sold through the course of the past week, and none of them totaled over 100,000 tons, but the total was over 200,000 tons, so it had to be reported now as a daily sale.
Absolutely. All right, take us over to livestock.
Kind of a tale of two different markets there, with hogs under pressure, so they're pulling back from gains that we saw in the August contract yesterday. The cattle market, it's been under pressure this week, but now trying to rebound here into the weekend.
Yeah, feeder cattle really kind of leading the way. Thanks, Brian. Have a good weekend. That's Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady on Markets Now.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors.
America's Conservation Ag Movement would like to recognize the National Corn Growers Association for its efforts in contributing to healthier, more resilient production agriculture systems. To learn more, visit agweb.com/ACAM.
You guys, there's going to be livestock pavilions at the Farm Journal Field Days, okay? It's the virtual gathering that we've got planned for August. Well, not planned. It's taking place August 25th through the 27th. And there are going to be livestock pavilions where we're going to be able to talk about the worker safety inside of packing plants. We're going to be able to talk about cattle pricing. We're going to be able to talk about the situation with hogs and what we're looking at there. It follows the crop tour that is August. It starts August 17th with our evening meetings on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. They're virtual meetings. They're free to everybody. Just go to farmjournalfielddays.com and check out the agenda and get registered. Get registered for those meetings. They're free, and they're going to be full of timely and important information. We've got the free-for-all going. We've got Jim Wiesmeyer, Pam Johnson, Sean Haney. Jim, the idea of the meat packers suing OSHA, this gets to one of the key items in the phase four of COVID relief, and that is that liability issue. And the Senate is still looking to provide some protection for companies, for schools, for hospitals, everything.
Yeah, Chip, and there is a distinct feeling of bipartisan pressure growing on both the legal and the political pressure on the meatpacking industry. And so things are really changing in that, and this is not going to be an idle exception here. I think you're going to see it.
Okay. Pam, you were listening there during the conversation that we had with Mark Dopp from North American Meat Institute. And I think you probably heard the conversation that I had with Jennifer Shike about the Columbus Junction numbers. What are your thoughts here?
Well, I guess many, and I don't really know enough to comment, but I think, you know, the Columbus Junction one, the more I read about it, the more confused I get, because it was the State Department of Health that released it was 221 employees. And I guess had they found out it was different, why didn't we hear that? The optics are bad. It makes it look like a cover-up. And then I read the Tysons told the Iowa Workforce Safety, like OSHA, that there were 522 employees that were infected, and that was the real truth. So I don't know. It doesn't really help to point fingers to blame, but a lot of things really need to be fixed. So
right. Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Jim, this is as fluid a situation as we've dealt with in quite a while when it comes to an aid package coming out of Washington, D.C. What is the latest?
The latest is that we don't have a Senate package. It should come out sometime early next week, and that's why I think probably Colin Peterson postponed his press event, because he didn't have anything to comment on because the Senate plan isn't out. And I think my best sources, Chip, are telling me this could go into the first 2 weeks of February because of the issues involved in here. But bottom line for agriculture, Chip.
The first 2 weeks of what?
August.
August. Yeah.
Yes. But bottom line for agriculture, I'm content that there'll be enough funding available with either plan to do the necessary programs that agriculture needs. And even though the House bill does not include 2020 crops, again, our best contact is telling us the Senate language is going to be broad enough to encompass 2020 crops.
Okay. The funding in the Senate bill was significantly below the funding in the House bill. Is the Senate moving toward the House, or are they hoping to negotiate the House down? I'm talking about for ag.
Yes, it depends on how you phrase it, Chip. They're closer than you might think. Even though the Senate groups the $14 billion that USDA can spend anyway now as of July 1, but the House is greater relative to the food stamp program, you know, stamp. They'll come closer to the House, but again, for main crops and livestock and dairy, and I think there'll be enough for ethanol, there's going to be adequate funding. And remember, later this year, Congress, through appropriations, is going to replenish the Commodity Credit Corporation back, you know, to the $30 billion cap.
Okay. Okay. Pam, the Farmer Forum yesterday, on Wednesday, had a couple of your counterparts, your peers. We had Ken McCauley, past president of NCGA, Darren Enan, past president of NCGA. And both of them expressed some concern over how where we stand now with quote unquote farm policy, because of the ad hoc spending, because of the uncertainty, because you've got Colin Peterson, chairman of the House Ag Committee, saying, doggone it, I wish we had more control over what was going on. I don't think Senator Roberts would turn down more control over what is going on and how the payments are being decided. What's your take on the current state?
Yeah, you know, it's a catch-22, right? So people, unprecedented times, determine unprecedented decisions, but there are consequences to those, and we've talked about it before, and I agree with Colin Peterson, and I think Senator Roberts would agree too. It's so important to have policy considerations in the mix or that input going forward so that you get back to some kind of market-oriented farm program when this starts to relent. So I agree. There are concerns out there, but saying that, you know, people aren't, like you said on the earlier, you know, the permanent closures of businesses, the same things happening with farm businesses.
This
and
is
Chip,
scary.
You're seeing the difference in the Senate and House bill, where the House bill is very prescriptive. They're very detailed of where they want money to be spent. The Senate gives wide discretionary authority to the Ag Secretary.
And, you know, and one of the future questions once you get through these unprecedented times is how to get off this wheel.
Yeah.
Right? Because I really don't think that's discussed enough. That, you know, there has been 3 years here of, you know, the Trump administration has really stepped up and provided ad hoc programming to support farmers through the China trade battle that the president this week says it doesn't mean much to him anymore, which was unusual. And of course the COVID, you know, the COVID situation. So it's a case of, okay, how do we get to the other side of this so that we won't have to, this isn't such a big percentage of farm profitability in 2023 or 22, for example.
Right.
Yeah,
I
so agree, Sean. And it's not only how do we get off of this wheel, how are we going to pay for this?
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to have to pay for this somehow. I mean, there's going to be a reckoning somewhere when people talk about, well, your taxes are going to go up. Well, how are we all going to pay for what's happened because of the pandemic?
And how are we going to pay for it? And we're talking about through phase four. Jim, there's likely going to be a phase five.
You know, I didn't think so before, but now I think so. Yeah. You know, that could be announced a month before election, you know, for other reasons too. But yeah, this thing is not going, the COVID's not going to go away that quickly. And yeah, it's a dilemma for agriculture. I think when all's said and done this calendar year, net farm income is going to be probably 40%, around 40% income transfer payments.
Yep.
Yeah, that's not good.
I started putting the pencil to it this week, Jim, and I didn't like the numbers that I'm coming up with because it could be north of that.
It could be above 40. Absolutely. Yeah. USDA right now is 36%, so we know they're low. But this is the price you pay for a sector that you is vastly important. And if you want a relatively cheap food price policy, you got to pay for it one way or the other, Chip.
And not the only sector that's going through this, right? Like, think about the food service industry, restaurants. Like, I'm telling you, like, talk about being on the brink of just a huge percentage not existing again. Sure, some of the big chains will be fine, and you know your TGFI Fridays may still be around, but some of the independents, that's where the real concern should be.
Exactly. Exactly.
And yet we still argue about wearing masks, you know, and is it really necessary or I don't want to do
it. I think that got all blown up, Pam, because I don't.
I still hear it. I still see it. Yes. And, you know.
Chip. Yeah.
Yeah, Sean. I don't think it's that big of an argument. Well, if you want to wear a mask, wear it.
I'll tell you where it started is in a briefing, the president himself said, I kind of feel if you wear a mask, you're against me. So that's how that spun where people like, I guess I'm not against the president. I'm not going to wear a mask.
Well, you know, but at some point you got to decide that was a statement that was just, okay, it was a statement. And you've got to let reality take over. And you got to have Dr. Just a Bit Outside Fauci wear a mask while at the Nats game. Okay? Because he didn't, is what I understand. He did when he was on the mound, but when he got in the stands, he didn't have it on. I don't know.
Bottom line, the current research shows you, Chip, that 80...
On your favorite radio station or your preferred digital device, AgriTalk is live every weekday.
Rock and roll is not noise pollution, and we hope that AgriTalk is not either. Thank you for joining us today. We've got a free-for-all going. Pam Johnson, Iowa farmer, Sean Haney, Real Agriculture, Real Ag Radio, and Pro Farmer Policy Analyst Jim Wiesmeyer. Okay, guys, at AE Pork just tweeted at us. He says, anybody else find it odd? Elections are only a few months away, and there's no talk of debates. Is Joe Biden even the DNC confirmed candidate? Jim?
Yes, and there will be three debates, Chip, and one debate for vice presidential candidates, and they have signed off on the three, on the president.
These debates, I tell you, the last election round in 15 leading into 16 with the 17 Republicans on the stage, everybody was tuning in just because it was good fun to watch. Go back a year ago with the Democrat debates for the nomination, and it was the same kind of thing. Everybody's turning in just because mostly for the entertainment value. I was trying to stay serious and stay focused on the issues, but with Donald Trump and Joe Biden on a debate stage by themselves, Jim.
Well, both of them.
I don't know how I'm going to take this seriously.
Oh, you have to, Chip, because if one of the reasons that Trump thinks he may still win is that Biden will fall apart during one of the three debates, September 29th in Indiana, Notre Dame, October 5th, Miami, October 22nd, Nashville. But if Biden doesn't, it's over.
If Biden doesn't fall apart.
If he does,
Jim,
well,
if
absolutely.
Biden, if Biden does fall apart, it's going to go unreported. Even though it happens in front of everybody, it'll go unreported.
Conspiracy theory.
I think it'll be enough to really hurt him. And the only other two ways that Trump has to win is the economy, if it keeps improving. And a third one is if he goes on the only way Trump can is attack mode. Those are the three reasons I've been given is that he could still win. The debate,
I think
economy, and attack.
What if Trump? And shouldn't the question be also, what if Trump falls apart?
Oh, sure.
It could be. Yes.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
If Biden falls apart.
Well, yeah. the reason is because he's so far ahead. So you look for areas in which Trump can still win. That's why.
Yeah, exactly.
And he will stumble over stuff once in a while where it's like, man, what did Joe just say there? And the president does the same thing, but we expect it from him. It's kind of part of his brand and his hyperbole.
See, that's
right?
My problem right there, Sean. Not only do we expect it from the president, I expect it from Biden too, where they're going to say something where you go, well, that's wrong. That's completely not right. There's no way that 150 million people died from something.
No, and there's no way if Biden wins that the stock market's going to zero, which is what the president said last week. Like, so it's. I think Trump needs it, right? I think it's a disadvantage, though, for Trump if there's no audience, because he really did a good job in 16 with the debates. As he had the audience into it and had them laughing. He feeds off a crowd.
Yep.
An empty room is a disadvantage for him. If I was Biden, if I was in his coaching group, I'd say very, very little, stick to this script, and honestly try a lot of baiting of the president to try to get him into what we've seen this week from what the media has sort of done to him in some of those briefings is he likes to wander. And we'll see what these debates are going to be interesting. It's too bad there's not a crowd. I think that's a missing element.
Right. Okay. Hey, we got to go over to this. China's got a buying binge going on. They're buying U.S. ag commodities. At the same time, I joked about it earlier this week that bonfire that they had in the backyard at the consulate in Houston is going to make a great scene in the movie at some point, Jim. On one hand, we're saying, yes, they're here buying. On the other hand, we're saying, watch out for the commie, you know what.
Yeah. Well, they had a lot to get rid of. I mean, there was no question about that. But yeah, I think what's happening is what USTR, Bob Lighthizer, and Greg Dowd was saying early on, Chip, but nobody, very few people believed them, that the second half of this year, China's going to be a big buyer. But this is going to put leverage. China has leverage because Trump better not pull out of this phase one, because if he does, that's going to cost a big, huge MFP3 trade mitigation program, and this time corn's going to participate.
Right. I feel like even though President Trump said, listen, that trade agreement isn't nearly as important to me as it was, I think he was trying to make a point that COVID is his focus, period, end of story. It wouldn't hurt for him to put a little focus back on it, because China is, like Lighthizer said on AgriTalk a few weeks ago, second half of the year, watch out. It's happening, Pam.
Do you really think COVID is his focus? Because the press conferences I've watched, he hasn't said a thing about it.
Well, I said was that he said it doesn't mean as much because he wants people to think that COVID is number one, because COVID is perceptions. It's perceptions. We know that.
Well, he blames China for starting it all over the world. Yeah. I mean, that's where he's upset about.
Interesting change in narrative today in Canadian newspapers is that the Huawei CFO Meng is talking about how Canada was tricked by the U.S. into arresting her, which is a change in narrative. It's been all about Canada's decision over the past year and a half. Hmm. So all of a sudden, the focus is shifting off of Canada from China's perspective, and now it's become a U.S. decision, which I find very interesting and a change based on the events of this week.
Right. Okay, you guys, great job today. Appreciate all your efforts, all your thoughts. I just want to throw this out there because it's something that is happening Monday on the show, in the morning show. We are going to have a conversation with U.S. Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao. I'm really looking forward to that. And we'll be talking infrastructure, Pam. There's some big movement there.
Yeah, word of bill passed.
Yep. So I am looking forward to the conversation with the secretary. Have a good weekend. We'll talk to you guys again next week. Pam Johnson, Iowa Farmer, Sean Haney, Real Agriculture, and Jim Wiesmeyer, Pro Farmer Policy Analyst. Okay, you guys, come back this afternoon. We got a treat for you. We've got a conversation with Matt Bennett from AgMarket.net right here on AgriTalk.